In 1931, a really ruthless serial killer bled out after this massive shootout with police in New York City.
Right, we're talking 300 police officers surrounding.
Exactly, 300. And next to his body, they found a note.
Which you might assume was some kind of confession or apology.
You would assume that,
Yeah.
right. But it didn't say he was sorry. I mean, it literally said he was a kind man who wouldn't hurt anyone.
That is absolutely staggering.
It is. And welcome, everyone, to today's exploration. We are so glad you are joining us because today we're looking at a sermon that uses this exact historical story to prove a really terrifying point.
And that point is that every single one of us is, well, capable of that exact same delusion.
Exactly. So for our discussion today, I want to suggest we really take our time. We need a deliberate pace here to just slow down and truly examine the mechanics of human morality.
I completely agree. And our source material today is a complete, unedited transcript of a Sunday service. This was delivered on July 5th, 2026, by Brother Steve at the New Life Benson Congregation.
Right. And the message is titled The Sermon on the Mount, Are You a Murderer? Our mission here is to look at how this specific sermon systematically challenges traditional definitions of what it actually means to be a good person.
Yes. It forces us, as the listener, to really examine the extreme lengths the human mind will go to just to justify its own anger.
Absolutely. And it tackles the incredibly heavy psychological toll of holding on to hatred.
To really grasp the weight of what Brother Steve is doing, I mean, we first need to understand the environment in the room that morning.
Sure. Setting the scene is crucial.
Right. So he establishes a very specific tone before he ever gets to his primary argument. It is the day after the 4th of July.
Right.
And he opens by reflecting on 250 years of American history. He expresses this deep gratitude for the country, specifically noting how thankful he is, despite the negative rumors that are constantly circulating in the media.
So he builds this very comfortable, patriotic, grateful atmosphere for the congregation.
Exactly. And then he makes this remarkably sharp pivot right into his core text, which is Matthew chapter 5, verses 21 and 22.
And that pivot is where he introduces this rather profound historical argument, right? Regarding how religious texts were essentially gatekept.
Yes, gatekept. He takes the congregation back to the 6th century BCE, so during the Babylonian exile.
Right, a period when the Jewish people were forcibly relocated.
Correct. And according to the historical context Steve presents here, the Jewish population lost their Hebrew roots during this captivity.
Because they were assimilated.
Right. They began speaking Aramaic, which was the common language of the region at the time.
I am so fascinated by the implications of that historical detail. I mean, it means the everyday person could literally no longer read their own sacred texts.
And that is the crucial mechanism at play here. Brother Steve argues that the rabbis and scribes, instead of translating and illuminating the scriptures for the people in Aramaic,
They just kept the Hebrew text to themselves.
exactly, they kept it to themselves. If we look at the sociology of this, maintaining a monopoly on the language of the divine, well, that translates directly into maintaining absolute power.
Because the public was left entirely in a state of ignorance.
Right. Completely reliant on oral traditions passed down by the religious elite.
He actually makes a direct modern comparison to illustrate this, doesn't he?
He does.
He likens this ancient dynamic to the historical practice of the Catholic Mass being conducted entirely in Latin.
Yes. For centuries, the congregation couldn't understand the literal words being spoken.
Right, which inherently forced the masses to rely completely on the priests to mediate their relationship with God.
And because the people were so reliant on this carefully curated tradition, the prevailing moral rule that was handed down to them became incredibly superficial.
Superficial in what way?
Well, the teaching essentially boiled down to, and I'm paraphrasing the sermon here, do not murder or you will be punished by the local court.
Oh, goodness, that is staggering when you think about it. The eternal judgment of God wasn't even part of the equation.
Not at all.
Yeah.
It was just a local municipal warning.
It reminds me of grading morality on an extreme curve. I mean, setting the baseline for being a quote-unquote good person at the
Ooh.
standard of I literally haven't killed anyone today is an incredibly low bar.
It is the lowest possible bar.
Isn't it remarkable how human beings instinctively create rules that are exceptionally easy to pass just so we can feel self-righteous?
It's a fundamental human defense mechanism, and Brother Steve uses this historical setup masterfully to expose it. He argues that focusing purely on external actions is appealing because it is easy to measure.
Right. You either killed someone or you didn't.
Exactly. And more importantly, it's easy to succeed at.
Yeah.
But it completely ignores internal character.
Absolutely. Because if the only metric for righteousness is the absence of physical murder, then almost everyone gets to walk around feeling perfectly justified.
Which is exactly what we want. We want to feel justified.
But this institutional desire for a loophole didn't just stay in antiquity. To show how desperate the human mind is to justify its own anger, Steve moves into a part of the service that I found genuinely shocking.
I know exactly what part you mean.
He asks his congregation to do something incredibly bold.
He does.
Mm-hmm.
He instructs them to take a pencil and literally cross out a phrase in their Bibles.
Literally mark up the text.
Yes. The traditional scripture reads, "Whoever is angry with his brother without a cause." He tells them to strike a line straight through the words, "without a cause."
Wait, really? He actually instructs a Sunday congregation to cross out a line in the Bible?
He does.
That feels incredibly controversial. I mean, how does he justify literally rewriting scripture to his audience?
Well, Brother Steve leans on specific historical interpretations here to make his case. He argues that the earliest, most reliable manuscripts don't actually include that phrase.
Okay, so where did it come from?
He claims that a scribe, sitting in a room centuries ago, deliberately added the words, "without a cause," because that specific scribe wanted an excuse to justify his own personal anger.
The gravity of that claim is immense. He is proposing that religious authorities literally altered a sacred text just to give themselves an emotional loophole.
That's exactly his argument. And by removing that loophole, Steve argues that Jesus's true original intent was uncompromising.
Which is what?
That any anger or hatred makes you a murderer in the eyes of God. No exceptions. No justifiable causes that make it acceptable.
And to prove just how deep this human capacity for self-delusion runs and how desperate we are to find those causes to justify our inner venom, Steve shares the story we mentioned at the very beginning of our discussion.
Right. The staggering case of Two Gun Crowley.
Yes. Two Gun Crowley was a 20-year-old criminal operating in New York in 1931, and his reputation was built entirely on ruthless violence.
He was known for murdering police officers without a second thought.
Exactly. The sermon details the visceral climax of the manhunt for him. Crowley was finally cornered in an apartment complex, and the police were so terrified of this young man that 300 officers surrounded the building.
300. Just think about that scale.
Right. There was a massive, chaotic gun battle. Crowley was severely wounded, bleeding out, completely surrounded by the sheer devastation he had caused. And right next to him, the police found a bloodstained note that he had written in what he thought were his final moments.
And the note read, "Under my coat is a weary heart, but a kind one, one that would do nobody any harm."
It is chilling to hear those words in that context.
It is the ultimate absurd manifestation of cognitive dissonance. I mean, you have a man who has mercilessly gunned down law enforcement officers, engaged in a shootout with 300 policemen, and his genuine internal narrative is that he is a victim.
He honestly believes he is fundamentally a kind person who wouldn't hurt anyone.
Right. Brother Steve uses Crowley to hold a mirror directly up to the congregation. It is easy for us to look at a serial killer and recognize his delusion.
Yeah.
But Steve is challenging the listener here.
Challenging them how?
By asking, if a violent murderer can convince himself of his own pristine innocence, how easily do everyday people excuse their own bitter grudges?
Oh, that is a profound point. We construct elaborate internal narratives where we are always the protagonist with the weary but kind heart.
Exactly. We tell ourselves our anger is merely a righteous, justified response to an unfair world.
So we are writing our own versions of Crowley's note every single day to excuse the silent hatreds we carry.
We really are.
So if our minds are that heavily guarded by delusion, and if we are all carrying around this inner quote-unquote murderous rage, how does a person even begin to dismantle it?
That's the core question, isn't it?
Right. And this is where the exploration moves from identifying the poison to Brother Steve's deeply personal mechanism for extracting it.
Yes. Steve doesn't mince words about the cost of this anger. He bluntly tells the congregation that harboring hate makes for a, quote, lousy Christian life.
A lousy Christian life. That's very direct.
Very. He points out that it's impossible to experience spiritual joy while simultaneously seething with grudges. So he gives them a very specific physical ritual.
The burden box.
The burden box, yes. He tells them to take a piece of paper and write down the names of the people they hate. The people who have deeply, genuinely wronged them.
Okay.
Then they are to walk up to the altar, drop that piece of paper into the church's physical burden box, and place a blessing in the nearby blessing jar.
And he issues a strict command alongside this, right?
He does. He tells them that once those names go into the box, they belong to God, and the person is never allowed to pull those names back out again.
To understand why he demands such a definitive physical action, we have to look at the harrowing story Steve shares from his own life.
Yes, and this is where the sermon becomes intensely personal.
He reveals to the congregation that when he and his brother Bob were children, they were both sexually abused by their eldest brother.
It is a devastating vulnerability to share from a pulpit.
It truly is. He describes how that trauma consumed his entire existence. He woke up every single morning thinking only of his profound hatred for his abuser.
He explains that this all-consuming rage led him to start using drugs at the age of 13, just to numb the cognitive loop of his trauma.
Just trying to survive his own mind.
Right. He spent years in this cycle trying to forget his brother and the hatred. It wasn't until he found his faith that he was finally able to confront it.
And he states that he eventually forgave his abuser. And remarkably, he says he now loves him and prays for his salvation.
That testimony gives immense gravity to his instruction about the burden box. He isn't speaking from a place of sheltered theory. He is speaking from the absolute depth of human suffering.
Absolutely. But I want to pause here and raise a critical question about how he communicates this.
Sure, go ahead.
During the sermon, Steve playfully tells the congregation that they need to go to Lowe's, buy some lumber, build a bridge, and get over it.
Right, I remember that part.
Given the severe trauma Steve himself survived, doesn't telling people to just get over it risk oversimplifying the immense, grueling psychological work required to heal? I mean, that sounds incredibly flippant, almost alienating for someone processing severe abuse.
That is a highly provocative thing for a pastor to say.
Yeah.
And it's important we let that tension breathe for a moment. You are absolutely right that build a bridge and get over it sounds culturally dismissive.
It sounds like advice for a traffic jam, not childhood trauma.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But we have to look at why leaders sometimes use shock value tactics in sermons.
To break through those deep-seated psychological barriers we talked about earlier.
Precisely that. When a person is trapped in a cycle of self-justified anger, soft language often just bounces right off the delusion.
Right. They just justify it away.
Yes. Steve's personal background proves he knows exactly how agonizing the process is. He lived the nightmare of trying to numb the pain with narcotics. So when he uses a phrase like that, it's a harsh juxtaposition meant to shock the listener out of their comfortable victimhood.
Which brings us back to the psychological utility of the burden box itself.
Think of it this way. Harboring trauma and hatred is like keeping radioactive material in your pocket to warm your hands.
Oh, that is a brilliant way to frame it.
It might comfort your sense of justice in the short term, but it is fundamentally destroying your cells from the inside out.
So the burden box acts as a psychological lead line safe.
Yes. It is not a magic trick that instantly cures trauma. It's a physical mechanism to safely externalize the radiation. The human brain often gets trapped in cognitive loops, replaying the injury over and over.
So by writing the name down and physically letting go of the paper,
you are bypassing that internal loop with a tangible external action.
It makes the invisible visible. I mean, the action itself might take 3 seconds, but the psychological release it demands is monumental.
It is.
He is asking them to surrender their right to be angry, which, as Tugun Crowley proved, is something human beings will fight to the death to hold on to.
They absolutely will. This entire examination has taken us on quite a journey today.
It certainly has. We started by looking at the historical and linguistic gatekeeping of Scripture, how controlling the language of a divine text inherently forced the masses to focus on surface-level municipal obedience rather than genuine spiritual transformation.
Right. From there, we examine the profound self-delusion the human mind is capable of.
The striking image of Tugun Crowley, surrounded by the devastation he caused, clutching a note that proclaimed his own kindness.
It serves as a haunting reminder of how easily we alter our own narratives just to justify our internal hatreds.
And finally, we looked at the grueling but absolutely necessary release of that internal poison.
Through the visceral physical ritual of the burden box, and through Brother Steve's harrowing personal testimony, we see the immense cost of keeping that radioactive hatred in our pockets.
And the freedom found in physically letting it go. So now we turn this back to you, the listener.
Yes.
We ask you to reflect on your own internal world. Consider the quiet corners of your mind. Who are the people you secretly harbor anger toward?
That's a hard question to ask yourself.
It is. And perhaps more importantly, how much vital energy are you expending every single day trying to build a narrative that justifies that anger?
It's a heavy thought to sit with.
It truly is. But before we leave you today, I want to leave you with one final lingering thought to ponder on your own. It's an idea that builds on the source material, stretching it into our modern reality.
I'm listening.
If we were to truly adopt Brother Steve's theological premise, the idea that our internal silent anger carries the exact same moral weight as physical violence, how would that reshape modern society's approach to mental and emotional hygiene?
That is a staggering implication when you apply it broadly.
If we genuinely viewed our silent frustrations and our bitter grudges as literal acts of violence, would we radically change the media we consume?
Certain media thrives on making us angry, after all.
Exactly. Would we alter the way we participate in online arguments? How would it change the way we govern our daily thoughts if every angry impulse was treated like a loaded weapon?
It forces us to realize that the murky waters of the human heart are perhaps far more dangerous than we ever wanted to admit.
Absolutely.
We desperately need mechanisms to illuminate the hidden fractures within ourselves before they cause irreparable harm to us and the people around us.
We really do. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this exploration today. We appreciate you slowing down and examining these complex ideas with us.
It's been a profound discussion.
Until next time, take care and keep asking the hard questions.